So we were going to have a slide presentation to help follow along in the presentation of this topic this today. So let me get that up for you. There we go. Grief and the greater life, a theosophical perspective. So this seemed to be a worthwhile subject to continue this month's theme on awakening spiritual awareness. Because this subject is going to be presented from the point of view of the theosophical perspective, which we hope will demonstrate that the importance of this subject is that grief is a great way, a gateway to the spiritual life and the awakening of spiritual awareness. It is also very important for us to understand this idea because it will help us be better able to help and teach others. Because we all come in contact with the grief that comes from loss, either in our families or other families, and it's a good way for us to make theosophy practical, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of others. And we also want to realize that there is a transformative power of grief. It's not just emotional suffering. And to demonstrate that point at the beginning, perhaps set the tone, we're going to have a brief reading from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And as you may recall, Arjuna has just slumped down into his chariot next to his companion, Krishna, and is overwhelmed with grief and despair with the awful task he sees ahead of him, which will involve warfare and the death of many on his own, in his own forces, and the forces of those oppose him, who are constituted with friends and companions and family from an earlier time in his life. And so it begins, Krishna beholding him thus influenced by compunction, his eyes overflowing with a flood of tears and his heart oppressed with deep affliction, addressed him in the following words. And then we'll skip over to where he begins his instruction. Thou grievest for those that may not be lamented, whilst thy sentiments are those of the expounders of the letter of the law. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. I myself never was not, nor thou, nor all the princes of the earth. Nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. As the Lord of this mortal frame experiences therein infancy, youth, and old age, so in future incarnations will it meet the same. One who is confirmed in this belief is not disturbed by anything that may come to pass. So we might begin with consideration, what is grief? Well, grief is a universal human experience, as we have said, and it's as we'll see, it's not just sorrow and for one who has passed on, but it is sorrow and suffering that is a response to personal loss. Whether it be the death of a loved one or a deep change in one's own nature. And very often, the deep changes in the circumstances of our life can be crises that bring on grief. And we can also grieve for the living, as Krishna suggests. So, this experience of grief is accompanied by emotional pain, disorientation, sometimes to the point of a crisis. From a theosophical perspective, grief may be viewed within a spiritual context and be a gateway to deeper spiritual insight and the soul's deeper life. It is a sacred passage or a time when the soul can reflect on the deeper reality behind the physical appearances, leading to spiritual growth and enlightenment. And we have a few quotations from the writings of HPB, which help demonstrate this point. The first is from The Voice of the Silence. The tears that water the parched soil of pain and sorrow bring forth the blossoms and fruit of karmic retribution. The idea that even the pain and suffering that comes to us from our own previous actions can bear good fruit of spiritual knowledge and growth, endurance and compassion, if we but approach it from the right perspective. And that perspective is given to us in this second quotation, where in The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, page 245, 275, she writes, "Woe to those who live without suffering. Stagnation and death is the future of all that vegetates without change. And how can there be any change for the better without proportioned suffering during the preceding stage? Is it not those only who have learned the deceptive value of earthly hopes and the elusive allurements of external nature who are destined to solve the great problems of life, pain, and death?" A theosophical perspective sees life and death as part of a greater spiritual life and continuum. So, what are some key concepts in theosophy on life and death? First idea is the soul is immortal. We do not have souls. We are souls, immortal thinkers, if you will. And that this soul passes through many conditions of body, personality, and experience in a long series of incarnations. These conditions are temporary and are not the real inner being, the immortal thinker, the immortal individual soul. These conditions are limited vehicles and opportunities for the experience of the soul. So life and death are transitions of states of consciousness and being for the immortal soul from the physical plane to inner unseen planes of being. Death is not annihilation. It is not an end. Consciousness and life continue, but on another plane of being. This realization is the gateway to a greater life, a greater plane of being, living the spiritual life conscious of the eternal and changeless source and root of all temporary physical forms. That source is the great spiritual essence and life that unites us all, as we are all a part of it and one with its in spiritual essence. It is the enduring spiritual reality beyond physical existence and personal identity. It is the greater life that one can become aware of, even while existing in a physical form. So, what does Theosophy tell us about the journey of the soul after the death of the physical body? So, after the death of the physical body, the soul, the inner real being, transitions into a different state of consciousness and being from the physical one. The first state and plane of consciousness after the death of the body is called Kamaloka, the place of desire. This is where the soul sloughs off the lower passions and desires and leaves them behind, where they go through their own process of disintegration, just as the body does. The next state and plane of consciousness after death is called Devakan, the place of the gods. It is a state of rest, bliss, and spiritual assimilation for the soul. The experience in this state is subjective and is the result of the soul's unselfish and noble deeds and thoughts during life on the physical plane. Love transcends the death of the body. The bonds of pure love and spiritual connection remain and are not lost. The influence of the love of the soul in the Devakonic state may be felt by the beloved one still living on the physical plane and be communicated in dreams and protections. The assimilated experience of the soul, of its highest aspirations and tendencies, adds to the growth and character of the soul. After the Devakonic state, the soul is drawn back to physical existence in a new bodily form, the result of all its former deeds, good, bad, and indifferent. So, what is the purpose of grief in the soul's evolution? And this is a key point because there are many fine works done in the world to help people get through the pain and suffering of grief, whether it's for the living, for the dead, or for their own lives, and get on with their lives in a meaning and purposeful way. But as this talk is focused on the purpose of grief in terms of the soul's evolution, the evolution of that part of us which is real and permanent and does not die with the body, that's the key. So, from a theosophical perspective, grief may be a spiritual opportunity. Grief may be an opportunity for inner spiritual awakening, as it can be a gateway to understanding our deeper nature and deepen the soul's experience. Well, how could that happen? Well, even in life, we can become aware that there's a real part of our nature which is not reliant or identifiable with the physical form or personality, and transcends all the changes of the body and personality, and continues to exist even though the little form we occupied as babies and the little personalities of its wishes and desires no longer exist, have died in our sense. There's that part of our nature, the observer, the thinker, the sense of identity of I, that continues to exist. And grief can certainly awaken that. How is that possible? While painful, grief, when grief is embraced with awareness of the opportunity it affords to learn and grow, the pain of grief becomes like a fire that refines and transforms our nature. So even nature, fire, has a transforming process. We understand that there are great forests in which the natural fires caused by lightning and so burn down the brush and thereby give the opportunity for new seeds to sprout and grow to become deeper and greater forests. And so is it in our own nature. The heat of and fire, the pain we go through, refines and transforms our nature. What does grief do? It challenges the illusions of the permanence of all physical things and beings and can draw one to the longing for that which is true, real, and permanent. And so it's very easy for us to fall into the illusion that the temporary physical body of those we love or the temporary pleasure we get from certain experience is the real enduring and valuable part of life. But when it's taken away, whether by death or by accident, sometimes by our own disability, where those things we depend on in our nature, physically and otherwise, are no longer available to us, we become aware through that there is something beyond and that is really strong and real and permanent. So, in the process of time, becoming less attached and dependent on these physical things, one may learn to aspire for spiritual growth and improvement of the inner life. So, what else does pain of grief do? Well, it can deepen our compassion for all those who suffer, and at the same time, add to our own inner endurance and strength. It is said there are those who are great of soul who understandably incarnate into very difficult situations by in which they can increase their endurance and strength and compassion. But even if we are not great of soul, we soon learn that no matter how weak we think we are, we will endure. We will outlast the pain of grief because it comes and goes. Yet we continue to be the observer and the experiencer. And that gives us a certain sense of endurance and strength. So even in the midst of our own grief, one may become inspired to bring peace and comfort through the pain and woes of others. So, karma and rebirth or reincarnation are central doctrines of theosophy and therefore help us approach the mystery of life, death, and pain, the HPB, referred to in the secret doctrine. Karma and reincarnation are laws of nature that are just, merciful, and provide for unending opportunity and hope. Under the law of karma, nothing that occurs in our life is accidental or miraculous or lost in the world of cause and effect. Personal loss of whatever kind, with its accompanying pain and suffering, is woven into our lives as the result of natural causes and contains meaning for the soul's evolution. Reincarnation and karma assure that those who love each other deeply and spiritually are drawn together in future lives. Love endures beyond the grave as a powerful force. Reincarnation provides the means, and karma provides the opportunity for all deeply connected souls to meet again in future lives under new circumstances. And now we come to perhaps the most important part of this talk, because we have to acknowledge the reality of grief and its persistent nature in ourselves. But how can we take that painful emotional experience, which seems to have a life of its own and come again and again, be awakened again and again, whether we will it or not? What can we do with it willfully and intentionally to transform it into something beneficial to others? How can we take it to make ourselves better by study and otherwise to help and teach others? And we might say there are four pillars or four tools in the soul's box of faculties that can help us. One is, but all these we want to say not only help navigate the soul through grief to a greater life, we talked about the spiritual life, but even the practice of these four pillars or means will help those among us and we come in contact who are not necessarily familiar with theosophical ideas, means for the so that their grieving heart can find peace, understanding, and growth in the process of grieving. So one can certainly help by having theosophical knowledge for themselves and others. But even if we are among those who are not necessarily familiar with theosophical ideas as we understand them or as they might find in their own tradition or background, they can be still helped with these spiritual tools. Because regardless of our race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, we are all souls in evolution, according to theosophy. And so we all have these same powers of thought and action, regardless of the external condition. So the first is meditation. And meditation, we all meditate. We all have a lifetime's meditation, something that occupies the focus of our mind. And very often, very commonly, that meditation is primarily focused on our own personal needs and the achievement of what we desire for others and those we love. And unfortunately, what we desire for those we do not love or despise in some way. But nevertheless, we have this way, this ability to focus our mind. But meditation in this regard is the willful and conscious turning of the mind to reconnect or be consciously aware of the higher self, not our personalities, we know as individual human beings, but rather that part of the nature of each and every human being, which is beyond the personality. As we said, that enduring sense of identity, I, the experiencer, the knower, the witness. And so during those periodical emotional storms of sadness, anger, guilt, fear, and doubt that may accompany grief, we can take a moment to bring our minds away from that and reconnect as we can with one's higher enduring permanent self, even to the point of reminding ourselves that we are the witness of what we're going through emotionally. We are not those experiences themselves because they will come and go, but we will continue to endure. This very practice detaches the mind from the power of the emotional nature and helps quiet the storms, as they will have no rock of personality or personal identity to crash upon. Because all these emotional feelings relate to how we identify ourselves with what we feel we've lost as persons. And if that is not there, that personality. The personal idea is not there because we are observing it from the perspective of the observer. We are invulnerable for that time from these emotional storms. They may still come again, but we have a means of refuge. So we let our focus be on the steady horizon of the unity of all life. It becomes apparent when one consciously tries to unite with their inner higher self. And so even on a raging storm, sailors and passengers are told to try to focus on the steady horizon so one does not get sick. And so the steady horizon that will help us deal with these emotional storms is in our inner nature. Focusing on that horizon of our inner spiritual nature, which is beyond the changes of the body and the personality. And this takes practice. But we don't have to wait to severe personal loss to begin to practice. Every day of our lives, we see an opportunity to let go of something that is we personally hold on dearly, thinking we need in order to be of better help to others. So we go through this process of transmuting our personal sorrow through loss, self-consciously if we desire, and can make ourselves better and stronger even without immediately in the time facing the personal deeper losses. So we let our focus be on that. The second tool or foundation is that of study of those eternal universal principles and truths that we not only find in theosophy, but all great philosophies and religions based on real eternal truths that are self-evident and transcend the wear and tear of time and place and continuously prove themselves to the earnest inquirer, and reorient our perspective by studying these truths to gain a spiritual understanding of our own nature and to learn how to contemplate on the internal mortal nature of the soul, because it may not be easy for us to immediately turn our minds in meditation towards higher things. And so study, prescribed study on a regular basis of these spiritual ideas is a way of training the mind through outer means of doing that. And Krishna tells us once you have learned this true idea of connection, you no longer are dependent on what is taught in the Vedas, meaning you're no longer dependent on outward spiritual sources of teaching because you've learned to find it within yourself. The third pillar that is one of selfless service, and this is a good beginning point for anyone, regardless of their knowledge of theosophy, because it is through selfless service to attempt to ease the sufferings of others results in inner peace and in one's own heart and mind. And students of theosophy realize this because we're all interconnected, and what we do to help others cannot help but benefit ourselves. But even those who are not aware of these philosophical truths realize in their own experience that if they can get their minds off their own sorrows and try to voluntarily help others, it is healing to others as well as themselves. So it is a way of transmuting our sorrow, our pain, into a healing force. Isn't that amazing? How we can take something which seems so destructive and transform it into something that is regenerative and healing. The greatest healers are those who have suffered illness of one type or another themselves, because they understand the cause, but they also understand how one can get out of that sorrow and go on with their lives. The fourth goal, or fourth tool, is that of sacred remembrance. Now, remembrance or memory can be a double-edged sword. And we know that grief can be very well up because we remember the object, the source of that which we love, and all the beautiful experiences that go with it, and our sense of loss. And we can find ourselves welling up with tears out of nowhere just from that immense memory. Just like the memory of even the memory of trying to eat a lemon can make our mouth pucker up with saliva. The memory of someone we've lost, a beloved one, can spontaneously bring forth tears and sadness. But there is a sacred remembrance, which is a spiritual tool, and that is to honor and remember the soul and life, what we should say, the life of the departed soul, and to make its victories and achievements an inspiration in our own lives. And we do that in the way in ULT when we have our special days where we remember and honor and the work of HPB, William Q. Judge, and Robert Crosby, but we honor and remember it for the work they did and why they did it and what they had to go through and how they were examples to us. And the best way to remember them is to put their victories, their teachings, what impressed us, to make it our own and make it our own source of inspiration. And in that way, they're not really lost from us. They become part of our inner being. So this is an inner communion of souls, which transcends time and space and planes of being, this kind of sacred remembrance. And it eases the clinging to the personality of the soul we knew on this physical plane. That soul, while on another plane of being, is not truly separate from us if we remember them in this way. Like we said, they become part of our being. Just as we might say in Devakan, the soul lives out the highest aspects of its previous life, and that becomes part of the character it carries from life to life. But when we do that, when we sacredly remember the highest of another human being who has left us, or another being, that becomes a process of assimilation which absorbs their character into our own. So this will help us remember their essence and not their form. So some closing thoughts on this subject, and we have mentioned them before. Grief can be a gateway to the greater life and spirit from a theosophical perspective. Grief is not a sign of weakness, but it's an indicator of deep love that has become directed to the form of the body, living or dead, and not the soul's essential spiritual nature. So it's evidence of our love, but it's a misdirection, maybe out of ignorance, maybe out of just not being aware, willfully or accidentally. That is why Krishna says those who are wise in spiritual things understand, are wise in the spiritual nature of the soul, grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. Grief can teach us to live for the benefit of living among, excuse me, grief can teach us to live for the benefit of the living among us, not to withdraw from life, but live to help others. And yet, at the same time, to remember the deeds of those departed in the light of the soul's immortality. And it gives us an opportunity to reflect on the unity of life, what is permanent and real, and the ongoing and deeper journey of the soul. Grief reminds us, if we learn from it, to live not only for this moment or this body and personality, but for and in the one eternal life of which we are all a part. And so, in terms of prompting some of our roundtable discussion, or for your later consideration, we just throw out these questions. What has grief awakened in me or us? Can I feel the greater life, even in the loss of grief or in the losses I go through or we go through from day to day? How might I serve others, what I've learned in the process of grief or suffering from loss of any kind? So we'll take off the slideshow here and open it up for your questions and comments. And we don't think that there are any final answers to this problem,
Was going to
but rather an opportunity for us to consider possibilities. What we can do in this inevitable condition of human experience that trans us and makes us better human beings. So your questions and comments are welcome.
Yes.
Theosophy Hall.
We were thinking that when we're grieving or we have lowered feelings, maybe even a sense of inadequacy or helplessness, that this is the perfect time to remember that we're all one and that it's to practice that impersonality. I mean, there's so many things that you can practice in grief. You can practice impersonality. You can practice dharma, just doing your duty regardless, and realize that, well, this is all under the law of karma. It's the doctrine of hope and responsibility. So we need to do our responsibility, but feel that hope. And it said, Mr. Judge said that something will, if we think back to when we were a time in our life when we were confident and felt good, that that'll help steady us.
Kind of a sacred remembrance of our own high points, not just the pleasurable ones, but the meaningful ones, the spiritual ones, the worthy ones, the things we valued in life. And that's, in a way, the value of daily meditation, whether we're fortunate enough to be able to do it once or twice a day. But take an opportunity to look at the experiences of our life. And in a way, they've come and they've gone, they've had their life, and now they're dead, except in our memory and what we recall of them. They may or may not come again in this life. But we certainly had emotional, intellectual, psychic, spiritual reactions to them. Some worthy, some unworthy. So it's an opportunity for us to practice in the moment, day by day, and benefit from, which will certainly help us when we have to apply it in more severe losses. It's very similar to the idea of the benefits of daily exercise. So when you really need it in a crisis, you have the strength to do it. Yes, another question from Theosophy or comment from Theosophy Hall.
The tools that were given during the talk, and the talk seemed to center on loss of a loved one. But what about, we were thinking of like in California with the fires, as much as those people have lost, and probably more, can these tools be used for material losses as well? I mean, these were whole neighborhoods that were lost. I mean, not just lives, but whole neighborhoods. So, can we look at using these tools in those situations as well?
We think so. We certainly invite other responsibles. As we said, grief is the way we respond emotionally to a loss that affects us personally. And it is not a weakness, it's just a sign of our deep feeling and attachment and love and appreciation and value. And of course, it doesn't have to be for a single individual. It can be for an animal, it can be for a pet, it can be for nature, it can be for a group of people. It can be for a nation, a community. And so the lesson there is we want to learn from that grief. How can we take these tools, understanding the purpose, the potential of grief, and use it not just to suffer, but to convert it into something that's going to be a force for good, a force for building, a force for healing. Whether it's among that community, whether it's among nature, whether it's among the animal kingdom, or whatever. So, yes, these tools can be used. Yes, we'll come to MDW and then AI. Go ahead, MDFW.
Yes, this brings us back to a conversation about the paramitas of viraga. Viraga is detachment, and it seems that this permeates everything that we do. Grief also. I mean, we know that when someone close to us dies, we feel the grief. It's like all those attachments we have to that person are being severed, and it hurts.
That's
And we've always wondered when people cry. Now, is crying a self-deprecating exercise? You're feeling sorry for yourself? Is that why we cry? Or is it something more than that? We often wondered.
Well, any physical action of the body has to be taken in the context of the inner cause, does it not? People cry when they're really excited and when they're happy, when they've seen loved ones they've been separated from for many years. People cry when they celebrate a tremendous achievement. People cry when they have certain neurological and physical problems. It causes a certain sensitivity or an unnatural response in their nervous system, and they respond, "My dear, cry." People cry at the smell of onions. So, lots of reasons we cry, and it's not a sign of weakness, but the expression of the very often the deepness, an overwhelming power of our feeling. So it says in the Light on the Path that we get to the point where the eyes are no longer incapable of tears. And we think that's an experience for some people and for many people. If they suffer long enough, they've cried long enough, they're all cried out. They literally say, "I can't cry anymore about this," or, "I'm done, I'm past this. I've cried enough, I suffered enough, I just this doesn't bother me as much anymore." They've become indifferent to the pain because they've suffered so much. And indifferent, just as one becomes indifferent to pleasure, too much pleasure repeated again and again and again, it like pain, you no longer get enjoyment out of it. You have to look for something else. So when it says become indifferent to pleasure and pain, it means you, in your path, you've been so much pleasure and pain so many times that enough already. You sense that you no longer respond to it. You're looking for something beyond, more permanent, more real, more truthful than the highs and lows of suffering and pain, the truth beyond it. That doesn't mean you won't continue to experience suffering and joy, but it won't affect you the way before. You'll see the opportunity, the growth, the opportunity to practice endurance, courage, the next paramita, vidya, which is excuse me, the opportunity to exercise endurance and power and will. Yes, AM, you had your hand up.
Yes, it was covered mostly in the previous comment. However, the thought still comes to mind that grief, it seems to conf it can it compels a form of involuntary self-study because it essentially forces us to do the inward turning, as was said in the talk, which is. It's a relentless examination of our own emotional landscape. So grief seems to awaken a yearning for something more enduring than the physical or emotional.
Well, it'd certainly be an opportunity to do that. Unfortunately, we know too many times people who have not yet awoken to that realization in grief turn to the bottle or turn to drugs or turn to various addictions or turn to other pleasures to temporarily numb their grief rather than to use it as an opportunity of self-reflection. And grief, in a sense, is a pretty strict teacher, keeps bringing us back again and again to the mastery of the subject at hand. Don't forget about me. I'm still here. I'm still here to re remind you about certain things you're not looking at. So question comes up in the chat, is numbness indifference? What do you think? Is numbness indifference? Well, it certainly depends on what you mean by numbness and indifference, but MDW, you have a thought on that?
Well, yeah, it's when one is numb, like one's not feeling anything anymore. It's like you're numb to all the grief. I mean, you've gone beyond it, and I just think it's you've taken it to the end. It's like it's the end. The numbness is a, but I don't think it's. It would be in any sense a detachment. I think it's just the, when we feel that way, we're like, we don't know what, well, how else to go or where else to go.
Well, we certainly see that when the mother or the father wake up in the middle of the night repetitively to feed or nurture or relieve the crying of their month-old or couple-month-old infant, perfectly numb to their own fatigue and numb to the work they have to do the next day, but totally involved in the necessity and the duty, but also the love of what has to be done in the moment. There's no way they're indifferent, but rather their numbness is to their own personal woes and sorrows only
Okay.
occupy. Now, grief teaches us that. Grief teaches us that, or can, because it can make us numb to our own suffering after a while. And eventually it will wear out. Normally, grief will wear out after a while, and it will only come back when certain memories bring it to our attention or certain cycles. And that's just a proof that those we thought we lost are still with us. Their memories, their influence is still with us, even though we don't consciously think about it. It's still part of our nature and wells up periodically like a virus again and again. But we saw a hand that went up at Theosophy Hall. Yeah. Go ahead. Theosophy Hall. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's a little trouble there.
Okay.
So in general, that is definitely one. Being numb to one's own feelings, and there's many analogies that are given about the mango fruit, let it be soft to others, but like the stone, be like the stone to oneself. And in the voice of the the voice of the silence talks about let each human tear drop on thy heart and never wipe it off until thou hast relieved the suffering of another. We're paraphrasing, of course.
Remove the cause of that suffering.
Right, so we remove the cause of that suffering so that we should feel sensitive to each other, but insensitive to our own woes. And that's the way to be truly compassionate. And those that are trying to numb through drugs, alcohol, many other ways, are just avoiding the grief and the pain, which inevitably will come, it's in due time.
Yes. So Buddha said, ye suffer from yourselves. I, Buddha, who wept with the whole world's tears, now laugh.
No.
And we have the same idea of Krishna, those wise in spiritual things grieve not for the living or the dead. So, what is the cause of suffering? What is the cause of the tears in the context of our discussion? It is ignorance. Ignorance not being a bad thing or a pejorative thing, but ignorance realizing that we're all ignorant in some degree. That's the purpose of our evolution, to unveil those clouds which make us ignorant. And through many lives, we gain more and more wisdom, more and more insight. So ignorance. There's people wiser than us and the people less wise. It's just part of our condition based on our own effort and evolution. So we're all teachers and we're all students. So we all have the opportunity to help another by either giving them some basic eternal principles that they can prove for themselves, or at least giving them the tools that we can apply. So you have a headache. Nobody here has to understand how aspirin works in the blood system and the brain and the nervous system and the muscles to relieve the pain. You just have the tool, you take the aspirin and you feel better. So we have the tools and the understanding to how to present these tools to people to help relieve their suffering and our own. AM, you have a question or comment?
Something related to what was mentioned previously about the existence post demise, something that's repeated at funerals is that even stars, when they eventually fade away, their light still shines for many, many years. And for most cases, we're still seeing the light from those stars that have died.
Interesting.
Similarly, something remains in us and shines on. For a good amount of time after we leave the scene.
Yes. And that influence, of course, is our legacy. Now we're not all authors and artists and musicians that we can write books and paint pictures and write music that has a legacy of intellectually, emotionally stimulating and helping others. But we all can leave a legacy in the effect we have on the human beings around us. A nucleus of universal brotherhood spreading out that light. And if we're fortunate enough to help even one human being, let alone ourselves, if one human being in this life find the path, find the way out of the darkness, because they're ready. That's a life pretty worth living, and whose light will continue to benefit others. It's been calculated if each one of us could influence and help one other person in our lives, And each one of those other people could only help one other person. In a relatively short period of time, all the people on this globe at this time would be helped. The question is for the individual to take responsibility to do that, to be that candle, to light even another life. So we can't judge our effect by how few we are, but by to the extent we help light that candle, even if it's dim, in those who come in contact with these teachings. Yes, I am.
We've heard that even the smallest act of kindness has the biggest impact during the Kali Yuga.
Yes, as that dimly lit candle has the impact in a dark room. And the thing with the Kali Yuga, yes, it's a dark age, but karmically, it's also an age where cause leads to effect much more quickly, so that an individual motivated by kindness, by service, can accomplish much more with the tidal wave and currents that are accentuated in this time than they could in a slower moving age. They can get to where they want to go in that ship a lot quicker. So we've come to the end of our scheduled time, unless there's any further comments or questions one has on this subject or related to it. Yes, I am. Please.
So, continue with the idea of things happening quicker. I know we don't like to rush things, but for the benefit of those who may be curious, how does one get to be a chairperson?
By building the chair, building the foundation, then themselves. That means study, work, reflection, and so we are not, we don't, we have individuals. When you think of a chairperson, you think of a permanent position held permanently by an individual. And that's not the case. We have a meeting, and we have a person who volunteers because of their having known how to build a chair, how to fulfill that service, how to fulfill that responsibility. Through their own study and work and effort and learning the skills. And so take turns. And the value of that is we get the benefits of all different perspectives and points of view, not just one. So, something to think about. Any other questions? Yes, MDW.
In our society, funerals are very much a part of the death process. The viewing the body and all of that. Now, there's something in me that finds it rather difficult. But on one hand, it's also, like a final goodbye or a severance of our feelings. But we always wondered, I guess the funeral is rooted in what, what does it embody? It embodies just the leaving go. Is it for that reason alone? Is for us to release our emotions or finally come to that point where we know that it has ended for that person, and that we So we always wonder when, so we know we've been to Irish funerals and everyone gets drunk and celebrates and probably all the Irish are laughing here. But I mean, in other traditions and the Catholic, it's different, and an Italian different, and everyone does it in a little bit different way. But I guess in all respects, it's just a saying goodbye.
Well, we have noticed a trend across denominations lately where funerals are not necessarily times for grieving, mourning, but times for celebrating, at least remembering and celebrating the person's life. And people will get up and take turns. Oh, we know they predominantly do this in the Quaker tradition. But people will get up and talk about the value, the benefit, and the virtues, and the joys of the person like living. So the one commonality, the one truth that runs about runs through it, is that in unity, in brotherhood, there is strength. Whatever activity we're engaged in life, if we do it together with a similarity of aim and purpose and opportunity, and that's what a funeral is. It's an opportunity for like-minded souls and hearts and minds to get together for a single purpose. We help each other get through it better. And it's the same here thing with our work at the lodge. In unity, there's strength and there's greater opportunity for the group for groups and associations and to grow not only together but even as individuals. So, with that, then those ideas, we want to call attention to the idea that this has been a whole month of pathways to spiritual awakening and awareness. Grief is not the only one, although it is a common one we all go through. But we will continue with that subject this Sunday. Attuning our spiritual awareness or attuning to universal consciousness, which is pretty much a continuation of what we talked about today, but how can we do that in everyday life? So, oh yes, please go ahead, Yasmin.
Well, it's interesting because, we have this whole idea of grief and how spirituality can affect it, and how and then last Sunday we had our the lecture on Easter, which is a rising up. So it was just kind of interesting to have both ends of the spectrum for this month. And then it's ending on this incredible high note on this Sunday about the whole idea of spirituality and consciousness.
And we think we can observe in Christians how the power of grief can be transformed into a resurrecting process within themselves. Whether they go through that whole period from Good Friday through Saturday through Sunday, the arising, it's all a transformational process, moving from the loss and grief to a time of spiritual regeneration, awakening. And what they do together, any human being can do with knowledge. Well, we want to thank you all then and make it a great evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Night.
See ya. See ya.